Hello, welcome to the Angle Podcast. Scario, how are you doing, man?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you doing?
Good, good. We have an interesting conversation today.
We do.
In a world that's moving towards fourth industrial revolution, we're talking smart cities, cashless economies, with concerns around exclusion. Who owns the data? Is this sustainable? Smart cities are promising efficiency, service deliveries, convenience, and the like, whilst the cashless economy is promising faster transactions, less cyber crimes, and the list goes on. But who owns the data? Is this sustainable? Does this give threats to exclusion? But here to help us unpack all of this is Dr. Thomas. Dr. Thomas, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
I am doing very well. Thank you for having me on this podcast. It's very exciting to be here.
Thanks. Yeah, good to have you. I'm just going to dive right in. I think, I know you've got, you were suggested to us by Prof. Geshi, I duly went and checked you out, and I saw that you've done lots of interesting things, done lots of interesting work in the space. Particularly, your little bit of background in some overseas cities, which I think through the course of the conversation, we'll dip into. I'm quite interested in your perspectives there. But I mean, just to kick it off, the term smart city is often pitched as the future of urban. Just to lay the groundwork a little bit for us, what is that actually, how you define that from your perspective, what does that mean in practice, a smart city?
I think in practice is the complicated question. It's been defined by a lot of different actors over the last, let's say 15, but perhaps 25 years, depending on who you ask. But the term really came to prominence in around 2009 as a giant marketing scheme by IBM. And while many people have tried to reinterpret it in several directions, and there have been successive waves of more or less successful reinterpretation, the dominant narrative put forth by IBM in 2009 is still pretty much the driving one. And that's the idea that digital technologies, so-called smart technologies, which is a bit of a tautology if you're saying a smart city is run by smart technologies, we can get into a little bit what that is. But effectively, a kind of digitalization of cities to be run on data, make decisions more effectively based on that in several different ways. It's really worth unpacking. That remains the driving idea. So the digital technologies will solve any number of real or supposed problems bedeviling cities around the world, and that it is corporations like IBM that are well suited to produce these technologies and then bring these solutions to cities.
Do you maybe have an example, a particular example that you've looked into whereby it's been a success or not?
There's any number of them. I mean, this has been around for a long time now. The one that I was probably closest to was back in Toronto when I was living there. Google's sister company, Sidewalk Labs, tried to bid on and almost successfully acquired a huge chunk of the city that they were going to build from the ground up as an internet-enabled city.
Oh, I remember this, actually.
Yes, it was a huge scandal. Yeah. There's a couple of excellent books have actually just come out about it, and a play that was extremely successful in Canada for a while on this. It's worth seeing. It's called The City That Google Couldn't Buy.
Oh,
nice.
And there's many aspects as to why this first went well and then went badly. But I think what's relevant to our conversation here is that Google had a very specific idea of what a smart city should look like, one in which they design and build the underlying ICT infrastructures, the information communications technology infrastructures, everything that collects the data, analyzes the data, stores the data, turns the data into value. they were going to manage that and then provide it as a kind of platform potentially to other organizations, entrepreneurs, et cetera, who could build solutions on top of that. But they would maintain control over a lot of this. And this then ran into several problems. There's one problem around just local, provincial, and federal level governance, which was a whole sort of uniquely Canadian thing that happened. But more interestingly for our conversation was around data protection laws and whose data was being owned and controlled by whom to whose benefit. And Google was trying to effectively do an end run around outdated privacy laws in Canada, because they haven't really been updated since the early 2000s and are woefully inadequate for our current age. And this is a problem everywhere in the world. And they were trying to redefine data that was quite sensitive and quite private that they were going to collect out of this city in such a way that it would not be protected by Canadian data protection laws, so that they could hold it and turn it into value, mostly for themselves. They claimed that the consumer, which is how they redefine citizens, which is a problem in and of itself, would be the end beneficiary of this process. But it's hard to claim when they're actually the ones holding on to the thing that is most valuable, i.e. the data. Then at the end, there was an attempt to restructure this as a kind of data trust in which that data would be held by a supposedly neutral third party, which is in theory a good idea and definitely worth pursuing around the world. That data trusts, data commons are excellent ideas. But in practice, by that time in the process, so much trust had been lost in this partnership between the city and Google that the project in the end floundered. Google claimed that they pulled the plug because of COVID in 2020, but really by that point they had engendered so much ill will against themselves amongst the general population that the project was no longer viable.
Yeah, that's a scary. You can't mess with Canadians and their rights. They're very, very much an activist type country.
So it's the Canadian himself. What went wrong there? Was it how the relationship was structured between the city and Google? Yeah. Whose project was this? Was this the city's project or was it Google? Did Google claim ownership of the project, like the IP of what this idea of smart city was? Why wouldn't the government maybe own the data and Google be the implementing partner? What relationship was that?
That's a very good question. There's many answers to all those parts. The primary thing that I think went wrong with it is that it started as a top-down project. Google came to the city with this proposal. It was not built in conjunction with the residents, in conjunction with civil society organizations, in conjunction with representative voices from marginalized groups in the city, etc. It came top down. It was delivered to the city as a finished project, as a finished model. There was no real opportunity to co-develop it from the ground up and let those voices, specifically the voices who are frequently most marginalized by technological development, have a say in how this should be designed. And it was telling that this was going to be a high-end luxury part of the city with expensive condos, expensive technology that most people in the city would not have been able to afford, let alone use.
Yeah.
And this is a problem that you will find in smart city projects pretty much everywhere in the world.
And how are we doing locally? How is Africa doing in this instance? are we going to have the same bottlenecks? I mean, I would imagine in that case, the problem wasn't that there was shortage of skills. I mean, Google is well equipped and well skilled to build something like this. It just was the relationship between the city and Google that did not fare about properly. Where is our problem as the continent, as the African continent?
I mean, just as a tack onto that question, like, is, I suppose it comes down to intention, right? I mean, is there trust of government or not? You know, a citizen, as you just proclaimed, is citizens feeling involved or not? And what would be the benefit for the citizens in the city? Is it going to give them some sort of benefit? I mean, Joburg, as an example, doesn't quite have a, they have smart city ideas and they're attempting some sense of, you know, portals and that, which, you know, cities like Cape Town are doing relatively okay with. But I mean, I'm not talking about just access to data. I'm talking about surveillance. You know, who controls that surveillance? Is it used for targeting or is it not? I mean, I understand these are like almost these pockets of discussions in each area, but, you know, just to maybe try and give us a...
Sure.
Yeah.
So I think by way of the beginning of an answer to that, so the Toronto example is an extreme one because it was such a big project. They were attempting to build a new city. And there have been several attempts like that across the African continent. In Lagos, for example, the Eco Atlantic and the IIBC projects were attempts to build, if not entirely new cities, at least entirely new areas that would be pretty high-end luxury from the ground up new developments. That's one approach to the smart city idea. These tend to not work well, and the research is coming in now that they generally tend to exacerbate inequality rather than mitigate it. That said, there are many other kinds of smart city projects that don't have quite such utopian, lofty ambitions. So rather than trying to build a new quarter or a new city, it's just about implementing a specific solution to a specific problem, right? It could be some kind of app-based mobility solution that allows people to more effectively choose their transit or regulate transit. It could be a smart meter that ensures the more efficient and effective delivery of water or electricity. Solutions like that tend to be far more effective. Not always, but when they are developed in conjunction with the people they're supposed to serve, and these people are given the opportunity to have a say in the conceptualization, design, implementation, et cetera, of these tools, rather than being driven by big corporate interest, they tend to be very effective. So the research has shown that not just in Africa, but in many places around the world, small scale, supposedly low tech solutions like that are extremely effective at raising living standards and living quality, whether everything from access to internet, to water, to electricity, mobility, it's information, etc. These things are great, but they have to take the local conditions into account. And the local conditions are frequently ones marked by quite severe digital inequality. So access to broadband internet, access to data, access to phones, access to skills to use those things once you have access, etc. So you need, projects are never just, at least successful ones, are never just solely technology projects. They're social projects too, because you have to take the social context into account. And when you work with the people that they're supposed to serve, make sure you're building up the social abilities of the people as well as just providing them with a tool.
That being said, is this a dream or reality for the African continent, given the concerns around mass civilians and the power crisis that we have? Can we get this right?
I absolutely believe that any country can get it right. There's many success stories already. That's not to say there aren't huge challenges. Power and surveillance are just one of them. I mean, there are any number of countries that have worrying turns towards digital authoritarianism. Out of 54 countries in Africa, 36 have data protection laws. And of those 36, 16 have properly independent data protection authorities. So a body, a government body that is independent of whoever happens to be in power who can enforce the data protection laws. That seems like little, but it is a dramatic improvement on where the continent was 10 years ago. So things are getting better rapidly.
Yeah.
I have great faith and hope that this will continue to be so, but more investment is needed, and more investment, not just in shiny technological solutions, you know, put in this piece of AI here or whatever, but investment in the fundamental sort of infrastructural maturity around governance, around laws, around state capacity to enact the government and governance and laws, oversight, et cetera, et cetera. Those things need to come, if not first, then at least in conjunction with the technological development. Otherwise, you do end up in scary surveillance state areas.
Yeah.
So I got to be honest about something. I'm having trouble pinning down exactly where I'm thinking about what a smart city initiative should be. Like when I'm thinking about a smart city, yes, there's lots of issues around availability of access to data and broadband and so on and public Wi-Fi. But I'm also thinking a little more in terms of sector-specific things, like in terms of sort of medical Medicare, for example, and hospitals. You know, you want to be in a space where if I'm in an accident in one side of the city and or whatever the case may be, that a particular hospital that's in that particular area should have access to my particular details that may be held in a different hospital. Is that, you know, that sort of data management on a ground level is kind of the space I'm thinking about a lot of the time, which often isn't so much in, you know, in the space that we're talking about at like a broader holistic level. So I'm just thinking, would that kind of thing fall under some sort of regulatory framework from a state level, or is that a city, is that a civic level? How would that kind of thing be managed, and really what would the benefit be for me to sign up for that? Or would I have to sign up for it, or would it be automatic? You know, these sort of legal frameworks where I get bumbled up a little bit.
Absolutely. And that's one of the big challenges right now, is to actually build a kind of infrastructure that enables what you might call a single point of access or sharing ability between different governmental silos. So for example, that your health records can easily move from your GP to the hospital emergency ward where you just got admitted, right? This is a surprisingly difficult thing to do. Every country in the world is still working on it. I think Estonia might be the only country that's actually successfully pulled this off.
Yeah, but they have like, 10 people that live there, so it makes sense.
But everyone's working on it. And
wait, but what's the challenge there? I don't get it.
Oh, it's complicated.
The challenge,
that's kind of why I brought it up, because it is very challenging.
How so? I don't get it.
So the challenge is that all the data,
databases that communicate, what's the challenge there?
Oh, they don't communicate. That's the thing. They're not connected to each other.
The solution is not to connect the two?
Oh, it is, but how? In a way that works and is safe and privacy secure. And so it's actually a major policy point of the South African G20 presidency right now.
Okay.
They don't call it smart cities, they call it digital public infrastructure. But it's effectively the same idea, just on a nationwide scale or even a continent-wide scale. And that is to create these kinds of digital infrastructures that enable a single digital identity that you can use to sign into any kind of service. It's always the same, so they know exactly that it's you. To enable the transfer of data, for example, between your GP and a hospital. And to enable financial payments, which you talked about in the beginning as well. And this digital public infrastructure has been a very big topic for the G20 for at least the last 3 years. It's a pretty major headline for sort of developmental investments, and it's being pushed a lot. It's important. As long as they learn the lessons from smart cities, which I hope they will, I think this has a much better chance of improving the quality of life equitably across the continent than smart cities ever did.
So what's the term one of our guests used earlier? Equality of outcome is kind of the point. Just to be clear, I mean, speaking to Stanley, from a technical perspective, when you're talking about two databases talking to each other, of course it's possible. It's relatively simple, right? But it's but you know, the framework and the legal framework and data privacy and access to and who holds the files and how does it all, that's the complicated part. It's like almost like a legal quagmire from my perspective.
Absolutely.
You're wrong.
Sounds very simple to me. Just lack of political will, you ask me. Let's build two databases and let's get this thing over and done with. What's the point of holding these files from one hospital to the other? What is this? If the Bella bill is, what is this other bill? The one that's creating these new insurances with the private sector? Part of that bill should be the fact that these files should be moved with ease. But anyhow, before we get lost into that, what Google gives us the convenience, right? And we share our data with them. We sign up on their platforms and we give them our data. They use that data for many other reasons, including making business out of the data. But we, because they give us the convenience, we give them our data. I think the banking sector has the same, we have the same trust towards the banking sector. They hold our money, so we trust them with our information. Smart cities, because largely are run by governments, do you find that there is enough trust from citizens to say, I can trust my government officials to hold my data? I mean, if I'm thinking about it, I wake up tomorrow with a criminal record that I don't know how, because maybe I said something on Twitter that the president doesn't like. How do you see the public responding to such initiatives? Is it something that we are embracing as a country, or what are the fears? I mean, we trust in big tech and banks with our data already.
Yeah. I mean, I think it really depends on which country you live in and how much you think your government is likely to see you as a threat. If you live in a relatively stable democracy, say, let's take Canada as an example, but there's several others, then most people have pretty high levels of trust towards the government. They don't think that giving the government access to their personal data is going to be particularly difficult, especially when the government is held accountable by the judicial system and independent data protection authorities. However, in other countries, that may not be the case. I mean, depending on what kind of minority you identify as, I would be severely worried if I lived in the US, for example. That's not a safe place to be. And that applies to a great many other countries as well. The world is rife with examples of people's personal data being gathered up by states and then used to repress, say, dissenting journalists or minorities or migrants or whoever else happens to be the enemy of the day. So yes, I think we should be very worried. And that's why ensuring that you don't only have data protection regulations as pieces of paper, but also with independent authorities with the power to ensure that the state adheres to them is very important. And most of these regulations also come with clear requirements about how much governments can collect data and what kinds, for what purpose, to ensure that it's only being collected for something that is absolutely necessary, and they're not just hoovering up everything they can. That said, most countries are guilty of doing just that under all sorts of loopholes around national security and policing. Those tend to be like exemptions you could drive a bus through in almost any data protection regulation anywhere in the world.
Yeah, again, from my view, it'd almost be the intention. I mean, yes, you hoover it up, the data, but I mean, I don't think the intention is always one for nefarious purposes. It's more like, I mean, what can you really do with it? How can you apply with it? So before I go down that rabbit hole, because you were talking about you know, bad governments and things like that. That's not really the space I want to speak about. Let me ask you a question. From your perspective, when you're thinking about smart cities, when you're thinking about what that means to you, what would be kind of an ideal scenario for you? Taking, say, a city you know well, like Cape Town, for example, or Johannesburg, what would be the ideal framework? How would that look for you? How would that operate from you and me kind of using it to, you know, someone else in a different socioeconomic bracket using it, and what would be the benefits? What would that kind of look like for you?
Cape Town's actually a very good example, because their digital modernization strategy that is now in second 3-year phase under Hugh Cole is very good. And I think a model for how to do this. So rather than focusing on flashy high-tech solutions, they've been working very diligently on ensuring basic digital maturity so that they're collecting data, storing it securely, adhering to privacy regulations, ensuring that people in the city are well-trained on the use of it, and then using it to deliver effective, efficient services to the public. That's the way to go about it. That, for me, is a smart city. It has very little to do with whatever the latest IBM flagship toy is, and far more to do with ensuring that fundamental services are delivered efficiently, effectively to the people who need them.
But and then who builds that
building on that?
Who builds that tech? In the example you gave in Cape Town, who builds the tech and where are the servers? Who owns the data? Is it the city?
I don't know exactly who's building the tech for the city of Cape Town, but the data should be owned by, the data would be owned by the city and controlled by the city and stored locally or on a cloud, depending on the exact solution they have.
Yeah, but I mean, if the city created this project using Google Cloud, can they claim that they own the data?
Legally, yes. Whether they control it or not is a slightly different question. That's where you start running into debates about what exactly sort of data sovereignty means for a country, for a people, for a city. If you don't directly control the data, i.e. if it's on Google servers somewhere else, then no, you probably don't control it. And your legal recourse, if Google says no, is tricky. And this is a problem for many cities, not just here, is you end up in this kind of corporate vendor capture of city systems. The ideal scenario is not that a Google or similar is building your city systems, but rather an open source software platform that you and others collectively control and have insight into. However, that requires know-how. It's much more complicated, especially for cities in developing countries.
And why do we keep going to big tech? Is it the regulation in the country or lack of skills?
Lack of skills, and also they're very persuasive. They have a lot of money to spend on PR and on lobbying. And
so they solve problems as well. It's like they bring a solution, say, boom, we can do this whole thing for you. We've got the infrastructure. We've got the skills. There it is. You pay us X amount. Everything gets solved for you. Most governments, particularly on a city level, most governments don't really have, you know, the skill level infrastructure. Not even just even if they have money to do that, to go into a hiring spree and build out what the project would look like, they still have to outsource their expertise, essentially. You know, and a big tech would come in and say, we can do all that for you. I'm not as concerned about data capture as my activist colleague here, but
leave me alone. I'm no activist
without discounting the importance of the issue. But I guess, you know, speaking from my particular perspective and the way, you know, my life runs and my socioeconomic bracket and so forth, my usefulness of a smart city would be access the data when I wanted, access to what data the city might have on me, and at least being able to see it. You know, access to things like ease of use and traffic. I mean, Google kind of does that for me already on Google Maps. I can see what I can tell by my route. But I mean, in things of like, how do I easily engage in, you know, community, simple things, man, like potholes, traffic lights, that sort of workflow into making the city work better from a reporting perspective and a follow-up perspective. You know, ESCOM, my meter broke a couple of weeks ago. I was without power for about 4 or 5 days, which is frustrating, right? I mean, but at this end, you want to be in a space where that works as well as possible. So that's when I'm thinking about smart city, just that workflow to getting things done is as seamless as possible. I mean, I don't know what your views are on that.
It's a frequently proposed solution to use apps as a kind of citizen reporting tool for anything that might be going right or wrong. Potholes is actually a particularly common one, but it can be any number of other things. The issue with that is not the tech, which is why I don't really see this as a smart city problem. Building apps like that is relatively simple.
Yeah.
The problem is, does the city have the capacity to take the information that you're sending it and then actually do something about it? The city's capacity to fix potholes has nothing to do with how good the app works. You know, that's...
No, exactly, that's, exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean, though. Like the whole workflow, the whole pipeline from me sign on to an app and make a report, it's like, yeah, on the other end, like the infrastructure from the city is to actually respond to these requests is an entirely different matter. Yeah, sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, I think, is where the smart city promise vision kind of falters in the face of the basic realities of how much money, skill, capacity do our cities have? And if they don't have it, then you can have as many fancy, flashy apps as you want. It doesn't solve the underlying problem. Mm. Data and tech can go a long way to making decisions more effective for allocating resources. I mean, that's effectively what smart means, right? It's a semi-automatic data-based allocation of resources. But if you don't have a lot of resources to begin with, you can allocate them as efficiently as one. You're still not going to fix all the potholes. That's not the problem. If information isn't the problem, then smart isn't going to fix it.
Yeah, got you. I mean, yeah, it's a very sort of, I guess, middle-class kind of kind of issue. I understand there's much larger issues to deal with. I mean, health being one of them, but and response to that being one of them as well. I suppose crime response being another one. You know, mm-hmm. you want, for me, I think it's almost like I'm a bit of a stickler for workflow. I like workflow. Like I like things, you know, knowing that if you do this, it leads into a certain sequence of events that solves the problem eventually. And crime being another one in the sense of, and I don't mean in just in the burbs. I mean in just general, you know, in my time I lived downtown here for many years. You want a space where, you know, everyone kind of feels like even the petty crime is kind of being watched, but then we start tipping into a surveillance type space, which has its own problems again as well. But I suppose again that the bottleneck there would be actually be able to crunch and monitor and respond to the data they're receiving, whether there's cameras there or not.
Quite so. And smart technologies actually came to policing perhaps even before they started coming to cities in that sense, because crime is always a kind of number one spending priority, and police budgets tend to be the biggest or the second biggest budget that any city has. So there's a lot of spending that happens there. And then a lot of this was also driven by the kind of post 9/11 war on terror, Department of Homeland Security effect that didn't just affect the US, it affected the rest of the world, this kind of militarization of policing that we saw. And out of that, over the last 20 years, we've seen a massive proliferation of surveillance technologies for police. It's not just in North America, it's elsewhere too. And what we've started seeing is a lot of these technologies are great for exerting police power, but they don't really change the kind of underlying discrimination that many groups face under police, because the technologies themselves are rarely neutral. Technologies aren't neutral because they are used and deployed in very specific social and political positions. So you can implement all of these tools, but unless you're, again, reforming the underlying institution, you're not going to solve the problems. You might give this institution greater reach and greater power, but if your aim is to make it more neutral, make it more fair, then that's not going to happen. Technology doesn't on its own solve social inequality. For that, you actually have to fix the institution underlying, whether you're talking about a city and a smart city or a police force and a smart police force or a state and digital public infrastructure, that makes no difference. Technology doesn't solve inequality on its own. For that, you have to look at the underlying social, political, and economic causes of it. Otherwise, it's just a Band-Aid at best. And in worst, which actually a lot of research shows, is it tends to exacerbate the inequality. So you really, really have to pay attention to how something is deployed and what the local context is, and make sure that the people who are supposed to benefit from it are involved in the solution development process.
All right. A bit of a technical question. I know Scott hates those. What is the difference between smart cities and digital surveillance?
I mean, I could be facetious and say none.
Okay.
No, there's the difference is just really what, I guess it's a question of what perspective you're taking, what outcome you're looking for. Surveillance is about tracking people, watching them to identify something, whether it's crime, or it can also be something as relatively innocuous as, like, there's a lot of surveillance of, say, traffic. just to see how traffic moves and to figure out whether we can make traffic more efficient, because everyone hates traffic. So let's try and make that better. Surveillance can be very effective. Like, we had a lot of surveillance during COVID as well. We're trying to track people's movements, trying to minimize contact, et cetera. And that worked well in some countries and poorly in others, depending again on the underlying state capacity to do something with that data. Unfortunately, however, this is also a good example of where many of these COVID-based surveillance trackers were then reappropriated for more nefarious uses to crack down on dissenters, activists, immigrants, etc. That has also happened. So a lot of these technologies are extremely dual multi-use, and this is where you need clear data protection regulations to ensure that what they are used for is beneficial to people rather than harmful.
So somewhat a little more specific question here in terms of, let's look at voting, for example. With the world rushing to digitize governance, what would you suggest we slow down for? I mean, what's your take on, for some reason, the government doesn't like me voting here. They'll take my taxes, but they won't take my vote, which is a bit irritating. But besides that, for me to actually go and stand in a queue and vote, it's a pain in the ass. That's why I think if you can make voting easier, you enable a sort of a more active democracy. I'm happy to debate that point. But from my perspective, if you make voting easier, particularly for people, in far-flung places, or, highly congested places, you want to make that as easy as possible. What's your view in terms of a role from a, broadly speaking, smart city initiative there in order to enable digital voting and how that might work in your space? Because it does plug into the bigger infrastructure that we're talking about, informed citizenry and so on.
Absolutely. I mean, digital voting seems like an inevitability. And as soon as the public has enough trust in the tech, it will probably happen. Like, digital identity systems that are slowly being developed and rolled out all around the world are the sort of underlying infrastructural precursor to a great many sort of citizen state engagement processes, voting of which is one of which. We tend to be a bit leery around voting for obvious reasons, very worried about voting fraud and all of those things, which is right and proper. But I'm not particularly worried about that one. I think that will come when the technology is trustworthy. I'm not a technologist in that space, so I can't speak to exactly how trustworthy it is, but it seems relatively inevitable and then desirable. As you say, it's great. Why should you stand in line for hours and hours to cast a ballot? I mean, that just seems so archaic at this point.
Can this term be trustworthy when people become data points and governments have tendencies of overreaching?
I mean, yes, that's definitely true. It's a problem, but it's been a problem for a lot longer than people think. Long before we had digital data collection, states were collecting data on their people for all sorts of purposes, some good, some less so. The technology is not inherently bad or inherently good. It's just a question of how it's enacted and with what protections and oversight.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to, I think it's difficult to really pin down the conversation because, we're talking about almost lots of little related but disparate issues that each have their own kind of talking points and sort of wells to go down. So it's hard to really pin down, smart city. It's a term it's really, really broad. I guess I'm trying to pin down maybe your perspective on it. I can't quite figure out whether I can tell you I'm generally pro tech. Like, so I agree with you in the sense of like the technology itself is neither good nor bad, but I'm very much for developing the best tech we can in order to enable all kinds of different services and benefits to the particular societies we live in. But sure, there are. And I'm less concerned about inequality because eventually everything will kind of catch up, right? Because there's other issues there in terms of access to data and access to your inclusion in that space, which is a different conversation in terms of your enablement and participating in a quote unquote smart city.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I suppose I just want to maybe have you kind of be a little bit free and kind of throw your opinions out there in terms of if you were advising the city of Cape Town or Joburg and saying, you know, what would be your cautionary points and what would be your points to go forward with based on what's happening now? I'm not talking about future developments or legislation, just kind of what's your general, I'm having trouble pinning you down, to be honest, maybe because you're not in the room.
Yeah. And I mean, the same for me, because in my head, I'm thinking, are we ready? And if we were to implement such solutions in a city like Joburg or Cape Town, what needs to happen from regulation standpoint? Speaking from a regulatory point of view, are we ready there? I know the technology is out there. Where are the bottlenecks? If we haven't done it, why haven't we? Is it regulation? What's the problem? Because everyone is on their smartphone. Everyone is ready for the solutions, but I can't get what the problem is with the smart city thing.
Like, what's your personal take? Not so much of a, you know, data driven take. You're just your personal viewpoint of what's possible.
The good thing to do is invest in capacity, your organizational capacity. So municipal capacity, if you're talking about a city. Ensure that you have educated staff, you have good policies, good strategy, that people are capable of doing what they're supposed to be doing. That's number one, absolutely. And then you can start working on the digital and otherwise infrastructure that they will be working with. So the data collection tools they have, the quality of data they have access to, the money and skills and expertise they have access to make decisions about what tools to use. And then you can start thinking about, okay, now what problems are we going to solve with this? You kind of have to do it in that order. The thing not to do is to do it in the reverse order, which is the order that most big tech corporations are trying to sell, right? They will come into a city and say, oh, look at this tool that is going to completely change how you manage stormwater or traffic or electricity or whatever else you want to talk about. And then they just plug this tool into the city that has naively bought onto it. And then it turns out to not work very well because a whole bunch of local characteristics and variables were not taken into account. And then it turns out the tool is incredibly expensive and requires maintenance. Like, I've heard this story a dozen times over from any number of cities. So working from the ground up, build state capacity or municipal capacity, build capacity in the people, in your staff, work with your citizens, work with your public to figure out what problems they really need solving, and then move on from there. I think the whole question of smart as the sort of overarching and driving idea is kind of a red herring. It's not really about the technology. It's about the same things we've always been doing with cities, is how to serve the public better. And as long as you keep that in mind and work from that perspective forward, it's going to go well.
I guess, that's a good that's a good framework. Yeah, that makes all sense to me. I think I was thinking while you were speaking, Joburg example of a really bad effort at not really consulting properly, and but it was a huge cost, which is now kind of just a dead project would be the ETOLs, those big ETOL project that we had a few years ago. That's an example on my side. This was the infrastructure and the tech behind that was smart. it was clever. There was good tracking, good database management. You know, everyone got their letters. There was shops set up in malls and so forth. Like, the whole ecosystem that built around that ETOL system was clever. It was clever. But it was kind of just launched on people, and everyone was like, "Nah, I'm not paying." That's just that, you know.
Do we know who built the tech?
Someone made a lot of money on that project. It's documented. I don't know who did it. It wasn't here though. It was overseas. It was overseas company.
So we didn't even own that data then.
Not as far as I'm aware. Could be wrong.
We could still use the infrastructure for something else. It doesn't have to be ETLs, though.
Surveillance.
Again, now I'm making people data points. Come on now.
I think from my perspective, we'd probably park it there. I don't know if you've got some nice closing statements, just in terms of what you're working on now. And you know, since you've come back this side, what are you looking into now? That's your business.
Absolutely, I do actually have something that I've been working on. Something I've noticed working here for the last few months, and that is an incredible sense of optimism and pride for what you might call the African perspective on these questions. I don't want to homogenize an entire continent because there are a great many different voices, different publics involved in this. But if you look at the state of the world currently in sort of discussion around tech and who's building tech and who benefits, et cetera, there's the US, which is having some difficulties. There's the EU, which is in sort of a retreat around AI and regulations, but unsure about what to do with themselves right now. And then there's China. Those were, until recently, the major voices kind of dictating the geopolitics of tech. Who gets to invest where and how and what kind of technology gets built. Now, with the South African G20 presidency and Ramaphosa's very clear statements on what a state should be doing, what constitutes good statecraft, what constitutes being a responsible state towards your public and towards your neighbors, I'm impressed and incredibly heartened by the direction the continent seems to be taking. There's so much good work. There are so many good cities and civic organizations pushing for a genuinely progressive, uplifting, cosmopolitan, humanist approach to tech that I'm really excited for what comes next, the next 10 years of technology out of this continent. I think it's going to be fascinating. And if anyone is going to take up the torch of technological enlightenment, I think it's going to be this continent. There's some really, really clever people, some really involved states, organizations, publics. And I'm very excited to see what happens next.
Nice. Dr. Thomas, say we wake up tomorrow and you are the number one citizen of this country. You're the president.
Oh, God.
How? Don't ask me that, how that happens, but there you are in Pretoria. At the state buildings, how are we building smart cities? How are we tying? How are we building infrastructure, legislation for smart cities, digital surveillance, and a cashless economy? What would be your approach for that?
Oh, invest in the people always first and foremost. Invest in the people. This country has such a vibrant, clever, engaged population. Investing in skills and capacity in your people is the number one thing you can do. From an early age onwards, schooling, education, money, opportunities, that's the way of the future.
So like President Ramaphosa, you'd say teachers take 2 years and just relearn how to educate for the digital transformation.
Absolutely. But it's not just about digital. I mean, that's the thing we're starting to realize. It's not really about technology. It's about general skills. The technology will come inevitably one way or another. I mean, if you think about it, we've had technology for as long as we've been human. I mean, it kind of marks being a human being, the first attempt to use a tool, et cetera. Technology is not the issue. We've always had it. It's just investing in your people to make sure they have the skills and the knowledge and the opportunity to be the best version of themselves.
Sorry, when you say people, do you mean the consumers of the intended products or the people that are mandated to administer the technology?
Both. I mean, ideally, you want your population to not just be passive consumers of a technology. A good technology, ones that make society better, tend to be interactive, flexible, that enable people to work with them and create their own solutions and platforms, rather than ones that just come as a prepackaged off-the-shelf thing that people can either accept or not.
Nice. Thomas, Dr. Thomas, sorry, I don't know if you require the doctor before your name or...
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for your time, man. That was interesting. There's so much in there to we could actually go down the rabbit hole in so many different topics that we touched on. But I think as an overview, that was great. I appreciate your time on that.
I appreciate you asking me and having me on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Thomas.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye.
Yes.
Guys, that has been the Angle Podcast. Please do like, subscribe, share, and follow us on all our social media platforms. Till next time. Thanks.
See ya.
See you.